So, and in fact, it's in this phase where the PhD students, Alina and Nuria, got perfectly nice results, and the senior scientist, in this case me, is ruining everything by trying to go back to the bases and changing the foundations of everything. So I don't know when it will be on the archive. So the idea is to talk a bit about kind of a higher view on thermodynamics. And so I'll start on the slides, and then I might move to the blackboard when it comes to specifics of this framework. And so the way I think about thermodynamics now is just as a resource theory, where the two resources, and this is the part that was not so obvious to me from the beginning, are information and energy. I'll explain what I mean by this, and then we'll kind of just generalize this to more conserved quantities. So let's just think about what is, when we say that we have energy and information, these two resources that we have, what's the kind of like thermodynamic object we have? This is what people normally call work. So work could be anything where you kind of know the state of the system very well, and you know that there's some resource of value for you there. So for example, it could be a weight that you lifted and that potential energy, and you know where it is, or a battery that is charged. Or in quantum thermodynamics, you have this idea of having like a harmonic oscillator, and for it to be considered work, you should know more or less where the state is. So this is like energy going up, the different energy levels, and the ball is like the population of each level. So for it to be work, you want kind of your uncertainty on energy to be very small, which means like the entropy of your battery is small, right? So this is the general idea. If you have energy and information, you have work. So it follows that if you have energy but don't have any information, so all you know about the state of a system is kind of the average energy but nothing else, this is normally what we call a heat bath. And in like classical thermodynamics, this is described by even a single parameter T, which tells you, we'll see one way to quantify it, but it's like it's proportional to the energy stored by unit of this path. In quantum thermodynamics, or even classical statistical physics, is given by a Gibbs distribution, a Gibbs state. And the properties of these states are that, like I said, like you fix one parameter that you know, in this case the energy, and then you maximize your entropy. So what's the state? How would I represent my knowledge if all I know is that it has this average energy, but I know nothing else? Okay. And then this gives you this distribution. The other property is that it's passive, in the sense that if all I have is a bath of this temperature, or even if I have many baths of this temperature, I cannot extract work from just one thing, right? So this is kind of the ingredient for a heat bath in general. So now what's left in traditional thermodynamics, at least in old-time thermodynamics, is not talked about, is what happens if you have just information and not energy. Well, in this case, this is what is called one example is a Sillard box, and because Landauer generalized this, I like to call them Landauer boxes, but because his name is a bit long, I even like to call them bit boxes. And what this is a completely degenerate system, which stores only information in the form of entropy. So the example with Sillard boxes is a box that has a partition in the middle, and you have a one particle gas, or it can even be many particle gas, but all you know is that it's either totally on the left, and this corresponds to state zero, or totally on the right, this corresponds to state one. If you don't know it, you don't know. So in these two cases, you have one bit of information about the system, but it has there's no energy difference between these two states. In quantum thermodynamics, this is much easier to do. You just take a qubit that is degenerate and just say, well, if it's on one of the states is called zero, the other state is called one. This corresponds, if I know which state it is, it's one bit of information I have. And if I don't know, if I have a maximally mixed state, it is one bit of entropy. Right? So now, I have these two resources, and we can trade between them. So suppose that now I have like some resource that stores work, something that stores heat, and something that stores just information, and I want to know what kind of operations I can do to exchange between them. And this will be familiar to many of you, which is the procedure of Landauer's erasure, for example. So suppose I have access to the heat bath, which is normally taken for granted because we all can work in some environment at some temperature. And then say, well, I want to get one bit of information here. I start from not knowing where the particle is. And there is this process. So this is exactly what a Szilard box is, which is like you attach a weight to it, and then very, very slowly letting this this one particle gas thermalize at any at every point, you quasi-statically kind of pull down here. Right? So that at the end of the day, you know that your particle is here, so you now have one bit of information there. And of course, you spend some work to do this. So what we have is this, right? So we had work stored here, and now the energy part of this work went into the heat bath. Okay, so and the information part of this work went into your box. So this is one way to think about Landauer's erasure. And so how much work does it cost? Well, it's directly proportional to the difference in entropy between the final and initial states in the box, okay, which in this case is just one bit. So this delta H is just one. It's proportional to the temperature of the bath. And the other things are constants. So log 2 is just a constant to exchange between binary entropy and the different bases. And KB is a Boltzmann constant. We will talk about this in a second. Okay? So the way I like to think about temperature of a bath is that it tells us kind of the currency trade rate between between work and information, right? And you know, probably most of you learn thermodynamics not starting from here, but starting from things. Okay, so sorry, just to say, this is a reversible process. So in the limit of large systems, you can run it in reverse. To again, you have information and heat, and you transform this into work. Okay. Right, so you probably learn thermodynamics not from this kind of procedure, but from something. This is the quantum case. It will be useful for later. So again, look, this is my box where I know nothing. Okay, so it's a fully mixed state. This is what I want to get to. It's erased, and I know I have one bit of information here. I start with a thermal state. I start with my work storage system at some well-defined energy level. And of course, like there's finite size effects. You don't get exactly this. But what happens is that you can do this by losing some energy in the work storage system, which is dumped into here, into the heat bath. Because some say that the heat bath is much, much larger. But again, the difference in energy between here and there is precisely that difference in energy there. Okay, so in this case, it's even clearer to see that, well, the energy stored here went there, and the information went there. Of course, there's always correlations between the systems. It's not exactly reversible, but this is the ideal case. Okay. So now you probably learn thermodynamics again from things more like Carnot engines, where you have access now to two heat baths, and you want to extract work from this temperature difference, right? And we can build this directly from the Landauer box. So if you not many people here to ask, but if you have an idea of how to do this. No? Okay, so. Yeah, I don't know. Does anyone know how to build something that can run at Carnot efficiency just from this protocol that we saw before? Yeah. So essentially what you can do is first you couple to the hot bath and you start with a pure state here in your box, and you lose the information here, right? Using the heat from the bath, and you gain some work. Right? And this work is proportional to the temperature of the hot bath. By the way, it's the same energy flows as heat to the environment. And then now you have a messy box, right? Where you have full entropy, you don't know where it is, where the particle is, but now you run the same procedure in reverse, connected to the cold bath. Okay. So then, in this case, you have to spend work to do this, but because TC is smaller, this bath is cooler than this, this amount of work you spend is smaller than the amount you gained before. Right? And in fact, if now you compute the overall work gain, so you gain TH times that constant, then you spend TC, and if you can rewrite this as, remember, this times TH was exactly the work that went into the heat bath. Okay. So then if you rearrange the terms, you have that efficiency, which is the work you gain divided by the heat that went into the hot bath, is precisely Carnot's efficiency. So one can build all of thermodynamics just from this building block. But why would you do this? The reason is that it becomes easier once we consider more conserved quantities. Okay. So now suppose that I have not just energy, but yeah, are there questions at this point? No? Okay. So suppose that, yeah, yes?
No, it's good, thank you.
Okay. All right, so now, just get some water. Imagine that I have more conserved quantities, like for instance, angular momentum, okay? Now let's think of a system that does not store energy, but stores angular momentum, and you have information about it. Okay? So this was studied by many people. I think the first example I know is John Vaccaro, more recently, Sando and Jonathan and Nicole did a more general case for the quantum resource theories. So, but one example is this turntables, or think of like a spin lattice, or a bunch of spins that are degenerate in energy, but they're all polarized, so they're all spin up. So you have information about the angular momentum of them, and it's a lot. Okay. Or if you just want to look at the quantum case, so think of a system that is degenerate in energy, but it's like a big spin. Okay. So in this direction, it's like how much angular momentum there is, and you know that it's in this state. Okay. So this is the same as your weight that you lifted, but instead of lifting potential energy, you just have angular momentum. And again, the same thing. So the uncertainty on angular momentum should be very small compared to the total. And in this case, we don't want it to store any energy. Okay. Now, if you don't have information, then we should have something equivalent to a bath, right? Or to heat. And we can do this again. So now it's the same idea. So suppose that you have, again, the same bunch of spins. They are generating energy. And you know the average angular momentum, but you know nothing else. Okay. And we'll see that you can, in the same way that before we associated each of these with a parameter, which was the temperature for angular for energy, you can have the temperature for angular momentum in the same way, right? If you just look at the quantum case directly, it's the same thing. So take the same system as before, but now we just plug in this exponential Gibbs states there. And the difference is that you just have a different observable here, nothing else. Okay. So what if we want a system without energy, without angular momentum, but which stores information? Then the same system as before works, right? The Landauer box, the same system as before. Works very well. So now once you have this, you can do exactly the same kind of procedures before. So there are examples for in the quantum case, where the only thing that changes really is that you do this with operations that overall conserve energy and conserve angular momentum, for example. And the only thing that changes is that what this quantum state corresponds to is to say that stores angular momentum work and not energy work. But because the system you used to mediate is the same, okay, and again, you get the same thing, right? Where you get, in fact, you can use this to define the temperature of a bath, the angular momentum temperature of a bath, as in like how much angular momentum work can I extract from one of these Landauer boxes using this. Okay? And because all these temperatures, they're always defined relative to a reference system, a reference path. Okay. So then you also have freedom to adjust to make a new Boltzmann constant for a new conserved quantity. And that's all. Right. Right. So now we can use this. I think this is the simplest way I know of trading between between different types of work. So if you have energy work, but you don't want to store energy work for some reason, what you want to do is store angular momentum work. Yeah. And so you have access to an energy thermal bath and an angular momentum thermal bath. And you want to build some kind of Carnot engine between the two again, or you want to just store things from here to here, then you can do exactly the same, right? You just put one of these boxes in the middle. You extract this work and store it as information in the Landauer box. And then you bring the box here. It's in a pure state. And you make it messy, and you get this work there, right? So this is how we trade between the two quantities. Okay? So far, so good. I think this is the last slide I have. So now I will move to the blackboard. And this is a good time for questions, if there are questions at this point. Yeah.
So
I'll show you. Sorry. Maybe I don't have more slides because I ran out of time. So can you see me at home? So the idea is that I take this.
No, you've moved it out of the screen.
I moved out of the screen. People in the thing? Okay. Oh, there, it's moving. It's moving to the back of the wall.
It's moving.
And it moved to the back. And it's coming to me. Come here. Yeah. Yes. Okay, good. Yeah.
Is that good then?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Do you have this?
Good.
And work E, and you take a box that's where you don't know where it is, right? And you use this to kind of to know you can take a bigger box or many of these boxes or so on, right? So you start with some entropy here, and you end up with entropy zero. So you store all this work as entropy, right? And this work was like this work E that's stored is K for your Boltzmann constant for E times the temperature E of your bath times this delta H. And you can add the log to it. Yeah. Okay, so this was all connected here. And now you take this box and you do the reverse procedure here, where you have your angular momentum bath with some TL, and you have your your WL that you want to store, right? And now you get here WL, KL, TL, delta H, log 2. And what's important is that this is like, right, so just like before, you build the Carnot engine by doing the proceeding in one direction with one set of resources, and in the other direction with the other set of resources. You do the same here, except so what you did was you converted this work into information here, and then you spent this information there to get the other work.
In the case of the standard cycle, where you have just two heat baths, the two heat baths have to be at different temperatures.
Yes. Yeah.
Is there a similar concept?
So it's about the It's about the ratios between this, right? So I think
it's the temperature.
It's still the like the overall temperature, right? This beta. Yeah. Let's see.
So those
yeah. Yes, if they are the same, you just don't. No, is that true? I don't think that's true, right? They can be different. So there is a degree of freedom that doesn't mean much, because the way you define temperature is via Carnot engines, right? So this is really just a constant. So you could use it to just scale all the temperatures here, right? And it's the same there. But you know, if the units used to measure work here are very different from the units you measure work there, then you kind of you scale up the k so that the temperatures are more look more comparable, something like this. Yeah. Okay. So this was just the introduction to motivate what we're doing in this work, which is again trying to think of thermodynamics as this resource theory, but in a kind of physical theory agnostic way, meaning the following. So one can derive all the rules of thermodynamics from just quantum mechanics. So these are the kind of microscopic top-down approaches. You say, I have systems, I have Hamiltonians, I only allow for energies that preserve the overall entropy and energy, so you know, unitaries that commit with a Hamiltonian, and from here, and maybe I give them access to a heat bath, and from here I derive all the laws of thermodynamics, right? But one can also derive thermodynamics without having any notion of the microscopic systems, and this is what we try to do here, also for the case of multiple conserved quantities. And what I've shown you so far is kind of the inspiration, the tools we use for this, and our hope is that this kind of formalism can be applied to many things. And it's a generalization of something that Renato did with Philip Carmelander a while ago. So I can just tell me how much time I have, and I'll give just really the very basic ingredients of this, so that people can say, I don't know.
We've reserved the area so far, so I'd say you've got another hour comfortably.
Okay. Okay, so and the idea is the following, is that I want to know if my physical theory has some thermodynamic behavior. So I'm going to give you kind of the desiderata that you should go and look for in your physical theory. And if you find them, then you all the laws follow from here. So I know I spent the last few weeks saying that systems are fictions, and they are, but they're useful fictions. And thermodynamics is something about exploiting nature. So this means the following: like the user goes into the world and splits the world into systems. Okay, and this is like parts of. The smallest systems the user defines are called atomic systems. These are the ones that the user does not divide into anything else. And then you can have subsets, right? This could be a system S that is form of three atomic systems. Okay. And again, this has nothing to do with the ultimate nature of reality. I could say that a box with gas is what I consider a system, even if I know that there is a microscopic description. Okay. Because, and this is a bug in the feature, so for each atomic system, AI or A, I define a state space. The user identifies a state space. And again, if this is like what in reality all the possible states are of the system, what I mean by this space state, these are like the equilibrium states of the system. So these are the states where the user can go and say, well, I know I can prepare this state or this state, and I can let it rest for 3 hours, let it rest between processes, and I come back and I have this. It doesn't need to be a microscopic description of the state. It can be a Oh, it's a gas at volume and pressure, PNV. Eh? So again, it's very important to emphasize that this is not the whole physical state space of the system. It's just what you consider like thermal or thermodynamic states, yes? And their meaning will be clear in a second. And again, this is the things for so if a system S is made out of a bunch of atomic systems, A1, A2, AN, then the state space of S is just made of products of the array of A1 tensor A2. Okay. And again, this does not mean that you cannot have correlated states, entangled states in your theory. It just means that for the purpose of this framework, what we consider thermodynamic states are the ones that are product. And if you want to really treat entangled states, then you just consider the whole thing one big atomic system. Okay, and this will work. We can recover the usual thermodynamic results. It's a bit cumbersome. But where this becomes more practical is then when we talk about thermodynamics of very large systems like black holes and stuff. Although I will not go into this so far. So just for notation, we call little states like normally sigma. And here we call sigma S. And of course, systems can have subsystems, which is any kind of, so this could be R. R is a subsystem of S if it's a subsystem. Okay? Okay. And reduced states then are very simple, because if I wanted to do rho S in this case, and suppose that rho S is just, rho R. And suppose that R is just the first two, then this would be just. And we know this is a limitation. Okay.
You can also use this bubbles over here.
Do you think they will move? Okay, so that's systems. The other thing we need, camera. I almost work with one. Work with sound, I don't know. If there's a human there, sorry. Okay. And then we define processes, and these are again like what the user can do. You know, I don't need to physically be able to do this, but I need to be able to imagine what would happen if this. For example, what happens if I throw some mass into a black hole? Something like this. So, SR processes that act only on a system S. So you can think of them as like non-dissipative processes. And by P. Okay, so imagine I have and what is the process defined by? So the process is just defined by the initial state and the final state of the process. So what this means is, for example, in the case of lifting a weight, if I'm just thinking of the process as lifting a weight, this corresponds actually in this notation to a family of processes, because each of them is like lifting a weight from this initial state where it's at some height to there. Lifting a weight from that height to there. Hey! Yeah. Okay. No worries. Oh, no worries. Okay. Do you want a 1 minute recap?
Sorry. Yeah, sure. That'd be great.
Okay. Motivation. You missed it. Framework for thermodynamics, where I don't know nothing. You define systems in terms of atomic systems that you build off. They don't need to be fundamentally atomic. It's just the smallest unit that my user wants to. Can be an atom. It can be a black hole. Okay. And states, for each atomic system, you have a set of states. And you consider only product states between the things, which in this corresponds to kind of equilibrium states that you can let things rest in between processes. Okay. Processes are defined again by one initial state and the final state of each process. So lifting something corresponds to a family of processes from lifting from this side, aside, leading from this side. Okay. And this can be represented by P on the largest system that it applies to. This is the initial state. And this is the final. And I hope the notation changes in the meantime because.
So the process is a given initial to final state or a set of initial to final states?
A process is one initial to final state.
Okay. And then think about the things around that means what?
This means the initial state of the process in the. On system S and the initial state of the process in system
final state.
And then if R is a subsystem of S, then you can also define this, right? So the reduced initial and final states, which you can always compute directly because all the states are product. Okay, so right. And then we impose some constraints. So we impose that there are always identity processes in any. So, and this is what connects to our interpretation of what the state space is. This notion that they are rest states is that the user should always be able to define a process that's just doing nothing on the system. So for all systems and for all initial state of the system, there exists a process identity on this state, which acts only here, such that this is the same as this. Yeah. So this is one ingredient we need. And the other ingredient is that we need to know what it makes a, what's the global view of a local process, right? So now if I go back to my picture, if I have a process that acts on these two things, it's really something that maps this here and this there. Okay. And of course, it doesn't tell me anything so far about the physical implementation of this. I can get out of the thermodynamic space state in the meantime because because the process really are just defined by the initial and final state for us so far on the global thing that they act on. It's like it's non-dissipative on the whole thing. And if I look just here, it looks like a dissipative process. If I look at just one subsystem. Okay. But I can define processes in principle just on a small system. And then I would like to have a way of seeing them. If I'm considering the whole thing, then what does this mean? And what it means is that for any other initial state here, I can always compose it with an identity there. Okay, so, and what?
You can erase that.
I suppose I can, right? It's passed. Oh. Okay. So this is, I call it like global view. So for all S, for all R that is disjoint from S, from other system that is disjoint from S, so and for all processes in that act only on S, and for all initial states of R, then we define this process identity R, which is defined by this thing. So on S, sorry, it's just this. And the same for the final states. Okay, this means that this for the initial and for the final states is the same, and that both initial and the final states, if I look just at subsystem R, this is sigma R. And I just impose that this is a valid process. Right? Yeah. Does that make sense? I'm just saying that.
Sounds like, is it just what you said over there?
It's just what I said over there. Yeah. It's just what I said over there. It's like, it's like, if I have a process that's just defined in one subsystem, I can have a global view of it, which is this process here and the identity on the rest, right? And I just had a chat, I think I told you about this, a chat with David the other day where I was thinking about, maybe there's some physical theories where this is not possible, where whenever I do a local process, I'm actually messing up everything else. But maybe in this case, I would not define it as a process just that acts only. Local system. Good. And the other thing that's missing is concatenation. And this really just means that if I have, okay, I'll just write here. So if I have a process that starts, if P does that and P prime does that, then I can concatenate them. This is a valid process. In particular, if now I have two systems, S and R, and I have P here and Q there, I can concatenate them using this thing. So I take P times the identity on the rest, concatenate it with identity insert Q, and I just need to make sure that the initial and final states match, right? And this is commutative in this case. Okay. So then these are all the little ingredients. And then we still don't have a notion of work here. And this is a notion that the user defines. So again, I'm not telling you what quantities you should care about. The user comes and says, well, there's a bunch of quantities of interest. I don't know, we call it conserved quantities. At this point, they're not conserved yet, but they will be soon. Let B. We call each conserved quantity B. This could be like energy and angular momentum, particle number, whatever the user cares about. And what the user needs to tell us is that needs to tell us how much it costs them to implement a process. Okay, so for each B and for each P in some PS, the user defines what's the B work cost in system S of implementing P. So this we leave up to the user. Later we make this explicit, but think of like the user as having some batteries that conserve these different quantities, which are for now they're outside the theory. Later we put them inside the theory. And for each process, we ask the user to tell us, okay, how much work of this type did you spend to implement this process on this system?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So is this like implicitly like a localized notion of work? Like you have a subscript S here?
So I was just about to double check this. Because I think we do it, we just imagine globally.
There's no subscript S on the calibration.
Yeah, I think it should be here, yes. I think it. Sorry. This will have, again, it will have some constraints.
S is the global system.
No. S could be a local system. But let me just check if the user specifies also which subsystem or not. Oh yeah, no. Yeah, for it. Sorry. So let's take the set of all processes is called P. For each process and each subsystem, the user tells me how much it costs, like how much work is done in this system to implement the process. Okay. Right. Okay. Good. All right. And then we impose the first law. And this is super constraining. And this is it's a postulate in the following sense, like if you can find this quality in your physical theory, then all the rest will follow. If not, you can try to restrict your set of systems, your set of states, or a set of processes so that you know all the results that follow will apply here. And sorry, here we just demand that it's additive in the sense that work is if S is the product of all this AIs, of these atomic systems AI, then this should be some. And there was one more. And that's right. And that if the process is not acting on a system R, then the work is zero on that system. That's all. Good. And we use the convention that this is positive when you have to spend work, when work is entering the system, and negative if you're extracting work from the system. Okay, so then what is the first law? This is super constraining, but it says that for all systems S, for all two states in the system, they are connected one way or the other. So let me see how they say. So there exists some P that acts only on these things that takes rho to sigma, or there exists some P that takes sigma to rho. This is again a limitation on your set of states.
So one of those two processes.
Or P prime. No, it's not exclusive war. It's not exclusive war.
But it could be just one of them.
It could be just one of them, yes. So again, you have like all these possible thermal states in the system, and there must be like processes connecting all of them. Which, And this gives you a funky order, I think, structure. They could even be both ways. But
is this just saying that all the states are connected?
All the states are connected. This is the thing, yes.
Okay.
And
okay.
So this is one thing, all the states are connected. If they're not connected, you just don't, you don't include them in your state space for this.
Yeah, it's as if they're separated.
Yeah. So are connected by a process that acts only on this thing as well. Right? So that doesn't include, for example, a heat bath or so. And the other thing is that for all P that are non-dissipative, then in all quantities, this is a function of just initial and final state of so this is again this is a constraint on how the user can define work cost and how the user defines non-dissipative processes, right? Sorry, non-dissipative are the name has changed. I don't know if it's still final. These are the processes that act only on one system. So I think non-dissipative because I'm not bringing in some other system and I'm not not bringing in the heat bath or so. Right, so that's good. Yes.
No.
I mean, it cannot depend on anything else. So if I have, so in particular, what this will mean, one of the consequences of this is that if I have this process and this, and I concatenate them, and I had another process that was this, they must have the same work cost if they're both non-dissipative.
Oh, right.
But,
can't depend on.
Sorry? Yeah. Okay, so this was, although with a different name, this was all in Philips. This is for, can I use that as well, or?
So, I mean, the camera.
I'm here. Yeah, I think I did. Okay. Okay. So then we can define internal energy like just like this. So we take, so if we have a system S, we pick this state to be a reference, one state, any state, to be a reference, and we define some arbitrary U of this thing. Or this quantity, ref. Okay. Which is a real number, and then we just define the entropy of any the internal energy or internal worth of some quantity B. On system S for any other state, rho, yeah, to be the work cost of a process plus now I need to check if I have this right. So let's think about it. So I have here my reference, and I say, oh look, I take any other state. If there's a process P that goes there, then I just define the internal energy of this state as being the internal energy of this plus the work cost of this process P. If P goes from if P is in GS and goes from my row. And if, because the first law just tells me that it goes in one direction, if it's here, then it's so it's minus work of P on S as B plus USB prime. Okay. Is that?
So U, just in words, U is, I'm not sure, so U is the.
So U is the, is like the internal energy.
So how much energy you can extract by going to the reference state?
Yeah. Essentially, that's it. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Negative means you have to do work to get to the reference
state. Exactly. Yeah.
The value of the reference state just depends on anything.
It could be anything like, yeah, yeah. It's a gauge sense. It's sensitive. And just take it to be zero, and then
because
yeah.
Of your first law,
because of this exists for every state. This is well defined for every state, right? And any choice of reference. Yes, that's right. And now, so now we have all this. Yeah, and you can have a different value of this for the different quantities, right? So for you also have the angular momentum energy and the number energy, whatnot. Right, because I didn't say anything about this being energy, it's just with respect to this work function defined by the, right? We have an example with, we have a gas cylinder that's rotating, and you can have, we think of what non-dissipative processes. Okay. So from this, the only thing left to do is to define heat. And that's just essentially the usual thing. So now we have all the systems. For all the systems, there are non-dissipative processes in those systems. So we have the internal energy everywhere. And then we just define it like, I don't even know if this is the. Right, so now P does not need to be a non-dissipative process on S. Right, so now, okay, so here's, let me do an example. So now I have these two systems, say R1 and R2, and I have a non-dissipative thing on the whole thing, right? So if I look overall, then the then these two things are the same. But if I look at a reduced system, like there could be a heat and work exchange between the two processes between the two systems in the meantime, right? Just like in this Landauer case that we saw before, I could be dumping heat in one system and getting work in the other, because these now are defined for each individual. Systems for non-dissipative processes, this could be different from here. Yeah. Does that make sense?
So if the process is dissipative, then it's equal to zero?
No, if the process is non-dissipative.
Sorry, non-dissipative, then it's equal to zero.
Because just by definition, right? So, sorry, maybe I should have said. So, you of a process. Is just the energy of the delta U of the final state. I don't know which one I use for final state in the system minus okay. Okay, so these are all the, this is the formalism needed, and then to derive everything else, what we need is, just like in the motivation, we need to start considering special resources, like what are these heat paths, and what are the general systems, what are these Landauer boxes, and so on. Otherwise, yeah. So then we can define, and these again are very idealized concepts, and maybe you don't have them exactly in your physical theory, but you have approximations of this. So an ideal, heat path for quantities, for some subset of conserved quantities. So B1, B2, B3. So this is an atomic system. It's a very large system, but the user is not going to go and look at subsets of this. It's just saying, I just take this as being a large system. And I say then that U, B prime, let's say it's atomic system, R for reservoir. This is will degenerate for all this. For B not. So I'm thinking of, I want a heat path just for energy, not for angular momentum. Okay, so all the states should have the same angular momentum. So I know I'm not storing any angular momentum. All the possible states of this bus should be doing this. Okay, and this is like kind of simple description. The other thing is a bit if I made a vector with the conserved quantities for which it is, then this is injective. Set of states. Meaning, I can pick from my bath, there's a state of any, if it's just an energy bath, there could be a state just of any energy in principle. Which means that I can just dump energy and it's still a valid heat path. It means it's so large, okay? And each vector for this is just the real. So it just spans the whole thing. So this is the idea that it's very large. And then we have the idea that it's where is it? Passive. And this is what is normally considered to be the second law. But the second law, the way it's done in thermodynamics, is really just a statement about this special kind of resources called a heat bath. And what this means is if I just have my heat bath and I have some other system, and I want to think of a global process that on the little system, it just returns it to the initial state. It's cyclic on the system here, but it could do anything. Then I cannot extract work from this. Right? This is true in the thermodynamic heat paths. It's true in the quantum thermodynamic heat paths. We just say, look, if you find a system in your theory that satisfies this, then it's a so for every conserved quantity, then you can call it a heat reservoir for any system S, and for any non-dissipative process that acts only on R and S, if it's cyclic on S, then the work you can extract, even when you consider two systems of P, the work you have to do to implement this process is larger than zero. You cannot extract work from this. Yeah.
Does this result depend upon what is the state of interaction between the system and the bar?
No, this is just in general. Yeah. Yeah, you could think of any process you can do. Like, again, if you don't find this, then maybe you cannot call a heat bath. Or maybe you need to restrict your processes to the ones that have the right strength of interaction so that this is satisfied. And the other thing is that it's translational invariant, meaning that, like, essentially, if you have some process, I'll put it here in the corner. It doesn't matter the initial state of the bath. That's the thing. If you have some process that works for some initial state, there's an equivalent process that works for another state. So you can have kind of compress these families of states of processes. So invariant, so I'll just write what it means in spirit. So for all processes acting on some system S and R, for all initial states of R, then there exists some process P prime that such that the initial and final states of P prime are the same as P. The initial and the final state are the same as P. I don't know which one is the initial anymore, but let's say this is the initial on R is my sigma R. And all the work costs and heat costs are the same. And like, we think this captures what we mean when we mean a heat bath in general, what properties a heat bath should have. Good. We can also define what it means to be a battery, a work storage system, and this is very similar. So maybe I can tell. So this is the same if it's a battery if it's a battery just for one quantity. Again, it should be degenerate in everything else. It's an ideal battery, so in principle it could store any amount of work. There's something equivalent to the translational invariance, and the thing that changes here is Let me do it like this. For any conserved quantity, they're a bit different, sorry. So, no heat. For any process that involves it and something else, you're not allowed to throw heat into your battery. This is what makes you, again, remember when I said in the beginning, what you consider like a good battery is something where like it doesn't get messier. You always know where the energy is. So the restriction on batteries is also a restriction on what kind of processes we can make there. Say, look, I have this battery, it's a perfect battery, and then I have this process that just shakes it. Like, okay, you're not allowed to do this process. You just don't put it in your set of processes that include the battery. It doesn't mean you cannot do it physically. It just means, like, for this concept. Okay. Good. And then instead of this invariance, it's like, let me call it moving the cut or make the work cost explicit. And the only thing is that for any process that you had involving some other system that had some So I'll do it here. I have some process in some system that has some more cost P that involves only one conserved quantity. I did not say what this meant. And has some more cost W. What this means is that I can always bring in this battery and think of another process that is like P prime, which does this here, does something here, such that the, you know, this work cost is the same, but you can find it there. When I have some systems I want to say these are my explicit batteries where I store work, okay, then you better be putting this work to there. Okay. Work satisfies this. And then I'll just talk about the last ingredient, and then I'll tell you that I think we can derive everything else from here. Maybe I'll tell you about my bathroom lemmas. Okay, then you can define what is a degenerate system, and it's what you'd imagine. Fully degenerate means that all the internal energies are zero, and if it's degenerate for all quantities except one, then you can, yeah, it's degenerate for all quantities except one. This is clear. An ordered system, is one where you can define two states. I give them many names. At the moment, I call like the source and a sink, such that for any conserved quantity, you can always find, and for any other state in between, you can always find processes that do this. And as negative work cost, meaning you can do this for free. You can even extract work in this case. So this is like the best state in the system, and this is the worst state in the system. Okay? And you don't necessarily need to be able to do this, but if you do this, then this should cost you work. Good. So then there's already a lemma, which I'm now calling the lemma don't work in the bathroom, which is just you can't extract work from a bath and a sink. Meaning that if all I have is one system S that starts in the sink, and then I'm given some heat bath. And now I'm just talking about one quantity. Then, of course, there's no process that could extract work from this. And the way we do it is by just, the way this is proven is just by concatenating it with other processes. So suppose that my process did this here. Right. Then I can always concatenate it with something there. And with something there, and I look at all the work costs, all these definitions follows. The other thing that follows is that, well, the best you can always do, if all I have is a heat bath and I want to extract work from some system, like I cannot do better than starting it at the source. Again, because of the way the energies flow. So from this, I can define what my Landauer box is. So a Landauer box is a system that is both degenerate and ordered, like the Szilard boxes. So it's fully degenerate, so I'll be able to use it to trade between different quantities. It also has at least one good state and one bad state, which could be just this thing, right? It could be just like, this is my good state, and this is my bad state. Like here I know that the particle's on the left, here I don't know anything. I don't even need to have all the intermediate states, right? And then what I need to do is say, look, for every heat bath of just one quantity B, I need to be able to have a process that's a reversible process that goes like this and uses just this and a heat bath. So if I hit this because it's because of all this stuff, it's going to be optimal. I can use this to define the temperature of the bath. Just again by Landauer's principle, right? By just W equals KT log 2 entropy of the box. I can define the entropy of a bath just by how much work I can extract in a process that goes from the source to the sink. I can compare different boxes of different sizes by taking always the same bath, and then I have different boxes, so I can extract different amounts of work, so I can define the entropies of different boxes. I can now trade between different types of energy, or different types of work, by the same way as before. And you know, from here we can also build these Carnot engines like I did before, all these processes that we did in the introduction. So we're now just at the phase where we're formalizing this this first result, and then we can have, you know, second law for multiple conserved quantities, which tell you how much work you can extract if you have different paths. But and then the part that is already done is the application to black holes, but I think for this you should invite Ladina to come and talk. She also gave a talk at the Thermodynamics Summer School, which is recorded. Yeah, so that's it. Like, I hope that when this is published, it can be useful to apply to different physical theories. That's kind of the goal. Thanks. And yeah, I take questions.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Rob, I see you. I don't hear you, though.
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about whether the following intuition is correct. So going back to the beginning, where you could, you know, spend work that came from, you know, having a weight lifted in a gravitational field and use it to perform work kind of in an angular momentum context with the mediary of the Sillard engine.
Mm-hmm.
So is this a good way to think about it, that if I have a bunch of thermal two-level systems, you know, I have a resource of energy. I could, you know, take the system of interest from the ground state to the excited states if only I didn't have ignorance about, you know, which of those qubits really are excited and which are de-excited. You know, the thermal state represents a state of ignorance, and so I basically am lacking information. And so what the Sillard engine really does is that it allows you to overcome your ignorance to extract the resource that's already there.
Yeah.
So that's a valid way of thinking about this kind of interconvertibility.
Yeah. I mean, overcome the ignorance. I think of it more like using the information that's in the box to get the energy out of the thing. But yes, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Instead of having information about your messy system, you just use this information about this other box somehow to access that energy.
The kind of resource of
non-uniform
distributions from
mm-hmm.
the Sillard engine context to resolving your uncertainty about some of the bath systems.
Yeah.
Okay, good. And so then my second question is, have you thought at all about generalizing Tobias Fritz and his co-authors' resource theory of work and heat into this more general context? Because that feels like a pretty natural framework in which to talk about kind of the interplay of information and other conserved quantities.
Remind me of which one this one is. This the quantum one or the more general?
So this is.
Or is a one of this?
It's more general, but the idea, the basic idea is that whereas normally we consider the free operations to be, include, you know, heat baths at a fixed temperature, for example.
Yeah, they don't.
Their resource theory, you know, any thermal state at any temperature is considered a resource.
Yeah.
So the only free stuff are the energy conserving ones. And so you could imagine just sort of the only free things are the ones that conserve all the conservation laws that you're interested in. And then every different kind of bath becomes a resource. And the question is sort of about the interconversion among them.
Yeah, so we did this for the quantum case. I have a paper with Carlos Sparacharia and Carlos Calando and Philip Weiss and Jonathan, I think. Where we do this for the quantum case, and I think it was precisely this. Yeah.
Okay, what's the name of that paper?
First law of arbitrary quantum resource theories of, or general first law of quantum resource theory, something like this, yeah.
Okay.
Because, look, I mean, the difference there is because we did, it's a microscopic approach, right? It thinks of quantum states. So all the results are asymptotic, they depend on some technical things that, yeah, you know how it goes. Whereas here it's more abstract. Yeah. But yes.
Okay, so it's not obvious from the title that this is about converting among different types of resources, like
but
energy, angular momentum, that sort of thing. But it is.
Yeah. No, we do talk specifically about batteries, and so it's also part of what inspired this work. It's like, we did this in the quantum case in the asymptotic regime, and now let's do it more generally. And then see if we get something cleaner that then we can come back and apply to the quantum case again. Yep.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yes.
So yeah, I guess I'm kind of a novice from the notes. So this, the framework you have, it seems very general. Okay, so two questions. One is, so what to extent does it go beyond, say, you know, established theory of
it's rich enough to cover quantum theory in very idealized cases, right? Entanglement is not a thing, so if you want to do like my raise quantum side information, then you need to consider both the memory and the thing as one single. So it's not, it's just, you know, you can cover it, but it's not super useful in this case. So the history of this is that Renato had to teach thermodynamics, classical thermodynamics at the university, and he decided to redo it and take this approach. So it should recover all the thermodynamic results. And the nice thing about it is that the axioms are very clean, and it's very easy to see what the recovers from what. Even like this version is already much more resource theory flavored. And with the multiple conserved quantities in this abstract case, that, like in the quantum case, it's been done. In the abstract case, I think not. I mean, I hope not, because that's the result, yes. Yeah. This goes beyond, like, and the application we do is to rederive all this black hole entropy results from kind of simple axioms, right? Because then you just need to say, okay, what's a black hole? It's a system. What are the processes that interact with it? It's parameterized by energy and angular momentum, say. Interacts with systems parameterized by these things, and they can interact in this way. So now you can throw all this machinery at them.
So you think, you know, that's one application of this framework. Tons of applications, situations where you have multiple conserved quantities.
We looked at just this gas cylinder, because it was just like a gas cylinder that's rotating, because it was just the simpler thing, but. No, we've not looked at other applications now. The goal from the beginning was, of this generalization, was to apply it to black holes. So we did all the tools, now we're cleaning up the tools. The application is there, it still needs to be published, and then we look at other things. But if you have suggestions, say, yeah. So the reason why I ran out of slides, despite Rob's beautiful talk earlier this week saying that we should prepare talks in advance, is because I spent most of the week writing a short story about quantum thermodynamics and these things. And I'm looking for better readers, if anyone wants. It's like 3 pages if it was a paper, but it's formatted two more. especially interested in those close to small children, because I need advice on whether this is a realistic portrayal of a kid. And it's about a nice factory in Portugal, and there's a lot of info dumping about classical and quantum thermodynamics, but it's all filtered by the narrator, who is a kid and couldn't care less. Yeah. Any more questions? Yeah.
Questions?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how off topic this is, or if it's something you covered at the beginning that I missed, but I'm curious about, I find this sort of level of abstraction to be very helpful to me personally, but also just help clarify some certain things. And it's nice to know what parts of the framework are external, like your constructions of what is considered your work functions. You know, there's mm-hmm. subject attitude constraints and the first law and all this. But
yeah.
Is there any, because everything that I was here for, I didn't see any sort of natural constraints on the way that conserved quantities interact with each other. It just seemed kind of
right.
When you have a conserved quantity, you have all of these terms and ingredients.
Right.
And they're
yep.
all subject in a sort of uniform way in the same set of constraints.
Right.
There's nothing, is the only medium through which you talk about the interaction between conserved quantities is somehow by mapping them all to the real numbers, is your quantities, universal quantities to interconversion?
So the quantities can or not be related. We don't impose this constraint right now, which, you know, these kind of things are a problem when you, for example, in quantum thermodynamics, now they commute or they don't commute, and so they will become a problem if you try to define batteries for just one quantity, but they always store the other somehow. So what we impose is the person, the user tells us, work has a clear direction. Negative work is good for you, positive work is bad. So for example, suppose I have angular momentum as a thing. And I could think of I have a resource that's a bunch of spins up, and a resource that's a bunch of spins down. They could both be useful. But I think, so we try to look at something that we can have baths with negative temperature to combine this. We find out that actually the best is to have, the best is to consider, these are two conserved quantities, the positive angular momentum, the negative angular momentum. And if you have a battery for a positive angular momentum, it means you have a bunch of spins up. If you have a battery for a negative, it means a bunch of spins down. And the what you'd consider a bath for positive angular momentum, a bath for negative, they are different things, right? Even if they're related. So I think it covers this thing. Even if energy and momentum are related, it still be covered. You might just not have a way to store just one quantity, right? So what this means is that when you define, I forgot to define, there's a set of processes on a system that is the ones that only affect quantity B, meaning that the work cost of all the other quantities is zero, right? And this might be very restricted if your quantities are very interconnected, and then maybe you just can't build things.
First thing I think about is how much structure of what the relationships between conserved quantities is an artifact of just your ways you measure things, or the actual structure of the underlying states of the abstract quantum.
So the thing is, because here at this point, I asked the user to define all these works, and then I define the sets P, B, S, right? And then everything I can make a bunch of statements for this kind of process that affect only one quantity. Then I can start trying to make processes for the ones that affect two quantities. But it could just be that because they are so connected, one of the sets is empty. Right? I cannot have something that just affects.
Yeah, it seems to me
positive momentum.
That structure in particular is
So the nice thing is that you tell me, and then it's reflected in the structure, and then once we're in the theory.
Captured by this concept of processes only affecting one quantity, subset of quantities at a time.
Yeah, and that will be the nice thing to to study as well. Yeah. Any more questions at home? No. Thanks.